I'd like now to welcome David Krakauer. He is director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. He's external professor at Santa Fe Institute, and he's moderating a panel called Complexity, Life, Scale, and Civilization. Welcome, David, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
So you are dealing with a little subject called the evolution of complexity and intelligence on Earth. And part of the problem, as I understand it, is understanding why little single-celled organisms swimming around in the water several billion years ago ever went beyond that state. What do we know about that?
Well, actually, it's even broader than that. At the event, we're going to be really spanning everything from the origin of the universe through to the origin of life, the origin of multicellular life, all the way through to the emergence of our own lineage, the hominid lineage, the culture that it produces, civilization, city-states, and their demise. And so, in fact, what we're really trying to do is ask, are there unified principles that span physics, chemistry, biology, and human culture that can help to explain why there's something in the universe, something interesting, something complex, rather than nothing at all?
There was a question that I heard somebody at the Santa Fe Institute asking, which I thought was very interesting, which is, does the existence of matter inevitably lead to life? Does it? Do we know?
Well, that's interesting. So we don't know. And so what can we say? We know that there was a big bang more or less 14 billion years ago. And very soon after that, we saw the formation of very simple elements, the sort of first row of the periodic table, hydrogen and helium. And then through what's called Big Bang nucleosynthesis, we created more and more elements. Stars formed, and in stars, the heavy elements formed. And that looks like it's more or less inevitable. Wherever we look in the universe, we see many different elements. We also see what happens when those elements come together to form molecules, and they accrete through dust to form planets. So wherever we look in the universe, we also see planets and we see stars. So in that sense, that looks inevitable. Where things get a little controversial is whether or not those molecules then do something really different, and that is they start to replicate and they start to compete for limited resources. That is, they become Darwinian entities. And that, as far as we know, doesn't exist anywhere other than on our own planet. And so it seems that there are two worlds. There's the world of the necessary that seems to follow largely from physical law. That is, atoms, molecules, planets and stars. And then there's the world of chance. And it seems that the conditions have to be just right. And biology and elements of culture seem to live in that domain. And so we don't yet know whether or not life follows inevitably from matter.
You are looking at the evolution of complexity and intelligence. And I know that you're a little averse to making definitions, and it's certainly hard to define intelligence, and it has a lot of different meanings. But what about complexity? That's a huge area of study at the Santa Fe Institute. How can you explain that to our listeners?
Right. So the Santa Fe Institute obviously describes itself as an institute that studies complex systems. And what do we mean? In some sense, a very trivial or simple-minded definition, which is nevertheless perfectly true, of complexity is things that are difficult or time-consuming to describe. And so take an example. Take a canvas or a painting that has only one color, yellow. It's very easy for me to describe that to you, and it's very easy for you to imagine it, right? On the other hand, if we take a Jackson Pollock or a Titian, it's much, much harder to describe. If I had to describe to you without showing it to you, it would take me much longer. And even then, I couldn't be sure that you had the right representation in your head. So we'd call the Titian or the Pollock complex, and we call the single color simple. And mathematically, we can measure what we would call the description length, how long it takes to describe something. And that is the essence of complexity and what we think happened over the course of the evolution of the universe and life in the universe, is that through various processes, necessary and accidental, more and more complexity emerged, meaning, in some sense, things that take us longer and longer to describe and to explain. So that, in a nutshell, is what's meant by complexity. Now, you might ask, what's simple? So here's an example of something simple versus complex. So if you look at the universe and the solar system, you look at the planets revolving around our sun, you might say that looks awfully complex. But it turns out it's not, because in fact, it's a bit like the yellow painting. Because if I tell you about gravity and Newton's laws, you can actually predict the behavior of the planets around the sun. It turns out that there's a very short description for the solar system. On the other hand, if you look at a body, there are no Newton's laws of the body, not, or at least not laws that we know. And that's a complex system. So the Center for Institute studies systems where there aren't these very short, very easy descriptions, where you can just write down in a few mathematical formulae everything that matters, where you have to write actually quite complicated computer programs or very many pages of mathematics. So complex systems are these systems that have that property of being fundamentally incompressible, difficult to reduce, difficult to simplify.
When you are talking about that distinction between simple and complex, is there any life form that is considered simple?
No. In fact, that's one of the great mysteries or inspiring mysteries of the universe, that the simplest cell is in some fundamental way more complex than a galaxy. That in the microcosm, you see greater structure, greater regularity, greater complexity than in the macrocosm itself.
That's extraordinary. I've always wondered, you know, they talk about the life cycle of stars, the birth, life, and death of stars. And is there any way in which we can think of as that being a real life cycle? Are stars alive in a way that's analogous to human life?
I mean, that's an interesting question. In some sense, I don't think so, because we understand basically the full life cycle of a star from its origin under the force of gravity, the fusion reactions that take place, the production of the elements, and its subsequently burning out and expansion and death, sometimes leading to the formation of a black hole. The biological process has in common with the sequence of the star, increasing randomness, what in physics you'd call increasing entropy. But beyond that, there are many, many details of the life cycle of an organism that are far more complex than the life cycle of the star. And of course, hidden within every cell and within the atoms of each cell are processes which are fundamentally similar to what's going on in the star. So in some sense, the organization of the universe is hierarchical. At the very, very smallest scales is the domain of physics, and that's true in a star, and it's true in the cells of your body. But then there are these higher scales, the scale of cells and tissues, and at those levels, entirely new processes take place that would be extraordinarily alien to a description of the life cycle of a star.
And so those processes that take place have to do, in large part, with replicating themselves and with learning. Is that correct?
Yeah, so you could sort of say, you know, say you're NASA and you're sending a probe out into the distant universe to look for signs of life. How would you know you had found it? It's a very difficult question to answer. And one way you could say, answer that question would be, well, look, we know that the basic physical processes give rise to the elements. And they give rise to the elements in characteristic abundances. So we expect helium, for example, to be very, very common, but uranium to be very, very rare. But when biology comes on the scene, these elements are forming molecules, and those molecules are forming things like DNA and RNA and proteins, and they're replicating and competing. And that process of competition is distorting the abundance of the elements and of the molecules predicted by physics alone. And so in some sense, deviations from the expectations of physical law are evidence of biological evolution.
So when you talk about the evolution of complexity and intelligence, I mean, those things are pretty much inextricably related. But what are the motives for complexifying and for increasing in intelligence as organisms have done ever since the first little cell started reproducing?
Well, that's interesting. And in fact, that's one of the really deep questions that we would seek to answer. So we understand some of the natural physical processes that lead to increases in complexity. One of them I've mentioned, which is the formation of elements and then the combining of the elements through electromagnetism into molecules and so forth up through cells after evolution is taking place. Now, intelligence, which I've spoken to you about before, is something to do with acquiring information from the environment that makes your survival more likely into the future. And, of course, inorganic or organic non-living things like the moon or the sun don't particularly care if they survive or not. That's the outcome of basic physical laws. Organisms, on the other hand, care deeply and do everything they can to ensure their survival. And one way that you can ensure your survival is by outwitting other basic organisms. And that's where intelligence comes into the picture. Organisms that are capable of extracting from the world information that they can use strategically are likely to leave more descendants. And that transition from the necessary physical law, processes that we understand fairly well, to the prototype, the earliest beginnings of inference, of intelligence, is something we barely understand. We sort of know intelligence when we see it in a very refined form, for example, in the brain of my colleague Murray Gell-Mann, right, or in Albert Einstein. But if I asked you, can you identify that in some sense special moment when the physical chemical universe made its first transition into a living universe with components that can sense the world and react accordingly? We don't really understand that moment. We sort of know approximately when it happened in Earth history, about a billion years after the Earth formed, let's say about 3.5 billion years ago, but we don't understand the ingredients of that event.
If intelligence is related to survival, a lot of kind of counterintuitive things happen immediately, because then you think, well, then viruses are smarter than we are, and all these people whom we think of as intelligent, some of them are not very adaptive in certain ways. They're not socially adaptive, and so it gets a little confusing when intelligence and survival are closely equated.
I mean, in some sense, that has to do with a very subtle point about the approximate nature of scientific theories. Scientific theories are very good at explaining average properties, but they're very bad at explaining particulars. Some of them are very good at explaining particulars, and those tend to be restricted to those very simple physical processes I mentioned before. And so, for example, if you ask me, on average, does a human have a better memory than a bacterium or a virus? I would unhesitatingly tell you yes. And I could do better than that. I could say humans are more strategic than a worm. But if you asked me about two, and those have consequences potentially for survival, but once you get to things where there are subtle differences of the sort that you describe, some very smart person who can't tie their own shoelace, right, and can barely make toast, right? Why are they so smart that they're incapable of looking after themselves? You've reached, in some sense, a level of resolution that is beyond our science. And And certainly there are psychological theories that might seek to explain those deficits, but they're certainly way beyond the scope of our evolutionary theories. So you have to somehow get used to the idea that science deals best with what we would call average quantities. And when it comes to the very specific things, we have recourse to description. We can place things in categories, but we often don't do much better than that.
We're talking to David Krakauer. Now, you're working on the evolution of complexity and intelligence on Earth, and there is a very large amount of data that is fairly new, the last decade or two, about genetics. How are you using all that work that's been done in the work that you're doing?
It's interesting because it's very, very early days in looking for principled connections between genetics and psychological cognitive intelligence. It's extraordinarily crude, in fact. You can say things like, when that gene is missing, you are in some sense compromised. But if you wanted to ask the deep questions, like, is this gene somehow responsible for my ability to appreciate the works of Mozart? Or does that part of my genome help me solve mathematical problems? That's so far ahead of our current knowledge. We know that there are correlates across species. For example, we know in many cases that there are genes associated with the formation of brain tissues. And so if you don't have those genes, you don't have a brain. But again, what most people want to know is the subtlety. They want to know what makes that person so good at playing the piano or such a great artist, and is that in their genes? And honestly, that's not something that we can explain now, and I'm not even sure we will be able to, because I think that's where culture largely takes over from biology. And I should emphasize that one of the things that we'll be discussing tonight, I think in depth, is the cultural domain. That is the world of the city-state, civilizations. And all human beings, by definition, are genetically effectively identical. They are cognitively effectively identical. And yet, there's extraordinary variation in the way in which we engage with our world, the way we represent it in our art, in our architecture, in our music. And I think that we crave not complexity but simplicity, and we would like for basic theories of physics and genetics to tell us everything about the world, and the fact is they cannot. And we need different theories to explain the emergence and decline of the city-state, theories that are fundamentally different to the theories that we use for biology, even though they could have shared principles. For example, that information transmission is maximized, or energy is used extraordinarily efficiently. That's true of cities, and it's true of our brains. But when it comes to predicting, again, the particular properties, each of these areas of research have their own very powerful frameworks, and in some deep sense, they stand alone.
The layman, yours truly, for example, can't help but notice analogies, and I don't know if any of these analogies are true or not, but for example, when you look at the division of labor within organisms, one of the beautiful things about the Stanislav Ulam lectures that you gave last year, which, by the way, are on santafe.edu, you can look them up, ladies and gentlemen, and see the videos, and they're terrific. But one of the things that was so interesting was that you made the distinction between a brain and a computer, because in a computer, the individual parts are not themselves intelligent, but in a brain, the individual cells are intelligent and have their own roles and have their own individuality and their skills. And so when you look at the division of labor in an organism, whether it be a human being or a dog or whatever, and each cell does something different, and then you look at the division of labor in a city, and some people do one thing and some people do another thing, and together they form this kind of larger, can you call it an organism, but this larger entity that's a city, one wonders whether those two things really are analogous and whether our biological reality is forming the kinds of structures that we make around us.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Let me just throw in an alternative perspective. One of the incredible things about cells, as you point out, cells have their own memories, have their own inferential powers, but in the collective generate brains that can do complex forms of geometry, right, and, you know, play tennis and, you know, win the Olympic Games. And so, but if you take a bunch of humans, all of whom have a very sophisticated brain putting together, they can behave in a way that's unbelievably stupid. For example, in a crowd, right? Mob behavior, that we might call it. And so that's quite complicated, the relationship between individual components and the collective. Sometimes clever components can produce super clever aggregates or collectives. And sometimes very clever components can produce unbelievably stupid aggregates. We call those bureaucracies, right? And so it's quite subtle, that relationship. And in some sense, what biology has done well is it's coordinated the cells in such a way that when they do behave together, they behave cooperatively, generating amazingly productive outcomes. But society, perhaps because society is very recent, I mean, if you think about the timescales involved, I mean, evolution occurs over billions of years. Multicellular life is nearly 600 million years old on our planet. But the civilizations that we study, we measure on the order of tens of thousands of years, right? Thousands of years. So we've had far less time to experiment and determine forms of government, forms of coordination that effectively increase the aggregate performance of society. And so, you know, one possibility is in time, in a million years' time, if we haven't destroyed ourselves, we'll have discovered new rules for interacting and cooperating that make us behave in some sense more like a brain. The other possibility is we'll never find them, and society will be forever stupid.
The work that you're doing in trying to understand these things on a cultural level, I mean, when you say maybe society will be forever stupid, is there a hope that through the work that you're doing, we can actually make not just individuals, but societies more intelligent and maybe more cooperative and things like that?
I think... You know, I would, in some sense, defer to my historian colleagues. I'm sure on the panel, many of my colleagues there will address this issue. I mean, this is a deep question. Have there been systematic trends? I mean, in some sense, it's true. I mean, one of my colleagues, Steven Pinker, who you might have interviewed at some point, has claimed in a recent book that human society per capita has become less violent in time. So that's an interesting trend that most of us would consider very positive. Many people have argued that that might not be true. But that's the kind of issue. I think in our own society, we've certainly seen progress. We've seen emancipations of various kind. We've seen liberties for groups that were formerly oppressed. I think there's no doubt that there is signs in society of progress. The deeper question for me as a scientist is, are there fundamental principles that say that must happen? And that's hard. To give you the most general fundamental principle that biologists, physicists, chemists, and some social scientists make form of, it's what's called the variational principle, or the principle of least action, sometimes called optimization principles, that things are built to be more efficient. Okay, and all of physics, whether it's the study of gravity, the formation of solar systems, and so forth, theory of light, all sit on this basic assumption that the universe optimizes. And so a ball rolling down a hill will roll in such a way that it minimizes the time to reach the bottom of the valley. Light will travel in such a way that it will take the shortest path. Darwin's theory was like that. It said organisms will adopt forms which maximize the number of genes they leave in the next generation. So when it comes to physics, chemistry, and biology, we live in this framework that we call variational, optimization-based. When it comes to society, it's not clear that that's true. It might be, and in fact, some of my colleagues on the panel, certainly Colin Renfrew and Jeffrey West, might claim that it is, that there are deep principles of optimization, like those we find in biology and in physics, that apply to cultures. And I guess the problem there is we haven't had sufficient time to determine whether that's true, and we don't really yet know what form they take. They will not look like Einstein's variational equations. They'll look like something much more complicated and different.
David Krakauer is the director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
He's external faculty at the Santa Fe Institute.
Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.